This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 248 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This episode is part of our Drums of Autumn read-along. To find out more and how to participate, visit outlanderpod.com/DOA.
And now, on to our read-along. This week, we will be discussing Chapter 34, entitled Lollyrock.
I always am afraid I'm still saying that wrong, even after how many years now?
A lot.
Of hearing people say it, hearing the show say it, I'm still always kind of second-guessing myself when I say it out loud. It's a personal thing. I'll get over it.
Brianna is in Scotland. She's traveling to Lallybroch on a horse named Brutus. Quote, "The big, white-haired farmhouse sat serenely in the middle of pale green fields of oats and barley, its windows and chimneys edged in gray stone. The walled kale yard and the numerous outbuildings clustering around it like chicks round a big white hen." Cindy R. writes, "Ah, now we get to the fun. Brianna makes it through the stones and makes her way to Lallybroch. I do like how we get to fill in the details of her journey through the stones, how she secured a horse and got directions to the farm. I don't have to have every little detail spelled out for me, you know. What a brave, courageous thing for Brianna to do. Alone and with only a basic knowledge of the area, her determination to find Jamie and Claire really speaks to her strength of character." Megan P. writes, "I can't possibly fathom the multitude of emotions Brianna is feeling as she looks down at Lallybroch from the hilltop. I love a woman with enough moxie to make that epic journey." And Erica B. writes, "Does anyone else know if Brianna has any experience riding horses? I don't recall either way, but I do wish we got a taste of her beginning experiences obtaining and riding Brutus and her tales of getting to Lallybroch. Was it so easy that she didn't get lost or scared at all?" Well, while we don't have those bits of her tale, we do have, it might even be more than a hint, we do have evidence of when she started riding, or at least maybe not an age, but we know partly how that started, and that was with her dad, Frank. Didn't they do more than just riding?
Didn't they do hunting and all kinds of other stuff? He took her out doing lots of outdoorsy stuff.
He had her get involved with more than just riding, yeah. And that's one of those things about, I mean, this part is actually what Frank knew. This potential what Frank knew is actually like the most blatantly obvious of anything. It's not really a secret anymore, or but yeah, there's a reason that Bostonian father teaches her young daughter, his young daughter, to, you know, make sure she can ride and shoot and hunt. I mean, that's does not make her into a tomboy, but it definitely is atypical for, even today, it's atypical for a father and daughter. It is done, but it's, I can say out of all of my friends growing up, I don't know that I had one friend who did that. So it still is atypical, but yeah, very interesting. And May kind of does point to some knowledge of something.
We're also dreadfully suburban.
That's true. Yeah, but they were suburban in Boston. They didn't live in the country.
They didn't live in the country, but New England is a very different society than here. And like, especially like when I lived in the South, I know they're not in the South, but when I lived in the South, I mean, you go 10 minutes outside the city and you're in a completely different environment. And we don't, I mean, we still have that here. I know there's tons of people who hunt and fish and do all that stuff. Just like,
but you may have to drive a little further. Yeah.
Well, yeah. But I mean, it just, I think it depends on the city that you are in as to whether or not there's a more of a proclivity for that.
So Brianna decides to just tell the truth as far as she can, as far as, you know, meeting people and telling them where she came from and how she got there. She's like, you know, I'm going to take my mom's advice. If you stick to the truth as much as you can, you don't have to remember the lies you made up. Less of a chance that you'll get in trouble. So she's going to stick to the truth as much as she can.
She's Claire's daughter. She's going to find trouble. That's just genetics.
And she's going to rely on her resemblance to her father to let people believe her.
That's just straight up hope. Because she doesn't know what her dad looks like. She's only assuming. Well, and then later in the chapter, and they're like, I'm Jamie Fraser's my father. Oh, really? Well, my mother says so. I'm like,
she's also wearing pants, and she's also wearing, I think, wearing a hat. So some of her stuff is hidden, like her long hair or whatever, or at least it's not out and flowing around. So she wonders if her parents are here at Lallybroch. She thought that they would be in America, but she doesn't know for sure. Last time we checked in with Brianna, and where we all knew or thought we knew where someone was, Brianna believes, last time we checked, that, or last time she saw her parents, or her dad at least, historically, was in the documents before her mom left. So they had traced him to Edinburgh. And so that was where, to the best of our knowledge, she was potentially going to look for him. Even though, well, she gives a little clue, doesn't she? She thought they'd be in America, but she didn't know for sure. She only knew they would be in America in 1776. So that's actually a clue from Diana. We don't know from Brianna yet, and we don't know from Diana yet. And Roger definitely doesn't know. Last chapter, he definitely knows now. He suspects that she found out about the newspaper obituary, right? So we don't see as readers that scene where she reads it. We never get that. But we get Roger, we get her going back and all this. So something spurned her on. And Roger's like, okay, yeah, I'm pretty sure I know what's going on. So Roger probably believes that. And then here we get Diana saying she thought they'd be in America. Well, why would she think they'd be in America? Last time they had both tracked them, it had been in Edinburgh, right? Because he never shared with her about the article or the obituary. So now Bree is saying, or we're reading that Diana writes, she thought they'd be in America. Okay, well, that's a hint. And then she only knew they'd be in America in 1776. So looking at the kind of the timelines that are kind of, you know, go together. So their 1776 would be her 1978. So she wants to go back before anything happens. So there's still plenty of time before 76.
It's June 1769.
So it took her. Okay. So she went back because it's 202 years in a normal, what Claire did both times and what she seems to be doing. So 69, 70, 71. So she went back in Beltane 1971 and arrived on Beltane 1769. And it took her from about Beltane till June.
Well, what I like is the chapter before. It's very specific. June 20th, 1971. And clearly she has lost all track of days in her travels because it's just Scotland, June 1769. She's like, I know what year it is, but I don't know what day of the week it is.
This week's episode is brought to you by Blue Apron. For 6 weeks from April 16th through May 21st, Blue Apron is teaming up with Airbnb to bring you the best home cooking from around the world.
Each week, their menu features a recipe developed in collaboration with an Airbnb experiences host like Cece, a chef from Shanghai who makes incredible kung pao chicken, a beloved sticky, saucy mix of crispy brown chicken and vegetables.
Blue Apron delivers fresh, pre-portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes right to your door that can be cooked in under 45 minutes. The menu changes every week based on what's in season and is designed by Blue Apron's in-house culinary team.
I look forward to this month's creamy pesto cavatelli. Don't forget, they have delicious vegetarian options as well.
This last week, I had sheet pan curry chicken and vegetables and my new current obsession, which I never would have suspected would ever become an obsession, coconut rice.
Ooh, how was it?
It's delicious. Well, I love curry anyway, but I never anticipated coconut flavored rice to be my new thing, but it's kind of my new thing right now. I wish more places would sell it on a menu. I'd buy it right now.
So check out this week's menu and get your $30 off at blueapron.com/outlander.
Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
So we can kind of piece some things together, right? So she went back on Beltane. We know that. That happens pretty quickly. And then between Beltane 1769 and June 1769, she gets a horse and makes it to Lallybroch. As she's there on her horse neighs and it's answering another horse. So another horse is approaching and it's carrying a man, young and very tan, he notices. And Brianna, we find out that she's wearing men's clothing. So then in that month and a half, she's also gotten some men's clothing.
I bet she went back in men's clothing, to be honest.
Oh,
I bet she's been wearing them the whole time.
Possibly the people who saw her go to the stones or whatever, it was reported that she had some kind of sack with her and she was dressed in walking clothes. So doesn't mean who walks in a dress. I mean, nowadays, right? So why not?
We should play the what's in Brianna's sack game. What do we think she's in her sack?
In her haversack? Not peanut butter and jelly.
I'm imagining a hobo sack on the end of a stick.
An oboe sack?
A hobo sack.
Oh.
On the end of a stick.
You need to aspirate more because I did not hear that H.
You need to open your earbuds.
My headphones. So she's this man on a horse coming toward her and we find out she's in men's clothing and this man says hello and asks how he might be of help to her. And he affirms that, yes, this land, this place is Lallybroch. Then she introduces herself as Brianna Fraser. Then Jamie Fraser Murray introduces himself. It's young Jamie. She says to him, she actually calls him, "You're young Jamie." And he looks a little bit affronted, like, "How dare you be so personal with me?"
And he's also older than her.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's funny.
So he was probably like, "Who you calling young lady?"
She says that she's his cousin and says, "Jamie Fraser is my father." And that gave me a little bit of teary. That made me a little teary eyed. And she's in.
That part didn't make me teary.
The place where she said who her dad was?
Yeah, not that point. There was a point later in the chapter. And teary's not the right word because you know I don't cry. But I was and I don't tear prick because I don't like that term. so I would just say I was emotionally affected.
Okay. You're non-committal.
Well, I'm very committal about the time that it occurred. I'll commit to that.
So after she says, well, he realizes what she's saying, who she is. He says a different word, which I don't say this word, but he says the J word. But he says, "Jesse, my mother will have kittens." I love that. I love that.
Did you just say Jesse?
I did.
Instead of Jesus?
Yes. I'm not going to take that name in vain. I can't. It just is not... Erica B. writes, "I need to work this exclamation into my everyday vernacular whenever I'm excited. It's adorable." Maybe the kittens part, but not the Jesse part. Look, if you say Jesse, that's all up to you. I'm not saying you can't say Jesse, but that's not funny or whatever or cute because everyone or anyone can say it. The kittens thing is what's funny. Megan P. writes, "I have to say that I have a hard time with Diana's description of Brianna. She's always pointing out the fact that Brianna has this huge, manly stature with a woman's figure. It doesn't make her sound overly attractive at all. It actually makes me think of Brienne of Tarth from Game of Thrones, who is more handsome than beautiful." What do you think about that, Sam?
Well, let's be honest, though. Brienne of Tarth. If Brienne of Tarth had, like, long, flowy hair, which Brianna has, and, you know, made herself womanly in any way, and being in pants and being in a suit of armor are two very different outfits. I don't think that it makes her sound mannish. I can see where she might see the comparison, but I don't think that she's overly masculine.
Brianna or Brienne?
Brianna.
Joe B. writes, "Brianna introducing herself as Fraser is further a part of her process of choosing and claiming her new identity, as this is the first time we see her introduce herself as such, of claiming a piece of Lallybroch as hers as she feels its pull and of taking her place in a new family."
Yeah, but let's be honest. If she showed up at Lallybroch and said, "Hi, I'm Brianna Randall," I think that name is enough to not make them hospitable.
Yeah, but because of the way I don't think I don't disagree that they wouldn't go, but I don't think they'd connect her with that specific Randall. She looks nothing like him. And also, Jamie can't have a
It's his butt baby. It's Jamie's butt baby.
Oh my God. Oh, I almost want to name the episode that, but I can't.
Jamie's butt baby. Do it.
Ellen and her presence. Did you catch that as they approached Lallybroch, there was symbolism of Ellen? Her presence is here. Quote, the great rose briar that overhung the door was newly in leaf, hundreds of tiny green buds just forming. So we have the first mention of Ellen. There's a lot of Ellen in this chapter. Bree, who is basically Ellen personified, looks-wise, right, is there. She's first. And then there's Ellen's roses. And then later on, we get the pearls. And then we get the painting. And then we find out about Bree's artistic talents. So Ellen is all over the place.
Well, it's in her middle name, Ellen.
Yes, and that's that. Correct. She has to get used to the fact that she has a lot of family. There's like she's got cousins upon cousins upon cousins. And as a single child, she is single and she's a child. As an only child.
That's better.
I'm
of the opinion that all children should be single.
Oh my gosh, please, yes. She has to get used to this idea of having a large family. They go inside Lallybroch and she sees the bevy of children. They like run by in little herds, it seems. She finds out there's a lady and a man there hoping to get some dinner. So I think it's Jamie, but I could be wrong. Someone in there, either Jamie who just brought her in or Michael, because I'm not making up that name. I know there's a Michael there, but I don't know who said this. I didn't write that down. But two people, they are in there because he was like, well, where's Jenny? Where's, where's mom? Where's grandma? And said, oh, well, she's in there with whatever. They didn't say who it was. And they're having snacks or whatever. And she's hoping these two, there's company, they're hoping to stay for dinner. So they're trying to make the afternoon snacks to stay long enough to get the meal. And Jenny is with them. And they're referred to as the Grizzler and her brother. So as she's getting to know some of these new cousins, Jenny comes out. All she can say is, oh my. All the while, Brianna can only think, please like me. Please be happy I'm here.
That's the moment.
Aww. That made me tear up too. Cindy R. writes, does anyone else feel a sense of contentment whenever the story is at Lallybroch?
I mean, that's kind of the point. However, I'm disturbed by the fact that they brought Leary back to Lallybroch because that kind of took a lot of... That may have ruined Lallybroch for me for literally the rest of the series. Just the threat that every time they go there, Leary's going to be there.
The threat. That's funny. She continues, Cindy R. I think it's just knowing how much this place means to Jamie. I always feel like I'm the one coming home. Can you imagine how mind-boggling it would be as an only child raised by... As opposed to a single child. Mm-hmm. Raised by parents who were only children as well. And probably single.
I hope so.
Yeah. Meeting the horde that is Ian and Jenny Murray's progeny. I know how cray-cray holidays can be with so many people under one roof. Imagine that on a daily basis. No thanks. Just as young Jamie. Okay, I have a question about that. So I think we've talked about it before, but I'm not trying to get into a discussion about introversion and extroversion. Like who's what and who feels what and whatever. Classically, or from what I understand, from what I've read and research I've done, and how I have aligned myself with definitions, introversion and extroversion does not have to do with how much you talk, how much you perform. If you're shy or not, it has nothing to do with that. You could be shy and be an extrovert. I mean, I guess. But the thing about introversion and extroversion is how is your energy sapped and how do you recharge? If you gain energy and you feed off being around others, that is extroversion. If you can be around people, but your energy is sapped, and in order to recharge, you need time, downtime and time alone, that is hallmark introversion. So I'll talk and talk. As you guys know, I will talk for days. Maybe not for days, but I'll talk for a while and I'll be around a decent amount of people, but I need my downtime. So I'm saying all of this to get into the conversation to mention what Cindy R. said. Could you imagine, or excuse me, not imagine, think about this. Back in the day before birth control, the whole of human history up until the 40s, 50s, the 60s, excuse me, 50s, 60s, when people typically had, say, five to 10 kids or however many survived, right? Could you imagine? Yes, I do think that there were people who preferred to have downtime. And, you know, it's an individual thing. It's not necessarily a cultural thing, although it could be, could have an influence. Wouldn't you maybe think that there are many more introverts nowadays than ever before in human history? The reason I ask is because the whole concept of like privacy, having me time, my own space, et cetera, like, you know, kids having their own bedrooms, that's a very modern concept. That, I mean, and I'm not talking about like the 0.001%, like the wealthy nobility and everything in history. I'm talking about the average family that had 5 to 10 kids or however many survived. All the pregnancies or all the births. If you had a lot of kids, you probably, you know, shared a rather small home. Beds were shared, or at the very least, rooms were shared. So this whole thing about, oh, my kids all have to have their own space, their own, you know, that's very modern.
I think that that's a reactionary response. So it's, and once it became within their means to either A, curtail the amount of children they have, and or B, make enough money to be able to afford to do more for the kids they have, I think that what people found important began to shift.
And that's what I'm saying. The ability to choose or plan or space the number of children, as well as, you know, coincided with women working more, and thus families making more money, and thus being able to afford more, and thus afford more for their kids, for the fewer kids that they did have. So yeah, so those things happened around the same time. So what I'm asking is, do you think the concept or the number of introverts is larger now than any time in history before because the culture allows for that?
Mm-mm. I don't think that we have more introverts than we had before. I think that we have more happy people. More happy introverts than we had before. I don't think that that particular part of humanity has changed all that much. I don't think that the basis of us as humans, the essence of human beings has changed biologically that much.
I don't think it's all biological. I think a lot of it is environmental. If you're an only child, or say one of two children, you have a relatively, you know, by whatever measure, I'm not proposing a measurement, but you have a relatively quiet life as opposed to growing up in a home with, you know, 7 kids.
Right. But just because you live in a very loud home doesn't mean that you're not an introvert. It just means that you're not finding ways to feed your introversion, and you have to come up with better or different coping mechanisms, or you learn to love the noise. I mean, you have no choice. It's the things you put up with.
Yeah, the choice was definitely not there unless you're older and old enough to have a book and go run outside and hide for a day. I don't know, to go read. But all I'm saying is I'm not saying it's 100% environment. I put money on it not being 100% genetic. I'm just curious because if you grow up as an only child, you're used to, you know, depending on your home, because if your parents have a lot of, you know, staff or a lot of family, or, you know, not family, but like events and, you know, parties, then, you know, you might be used to it. But then there are going to be times when there's not parties and you'll be used to having the attention of your family. You know what I mean? It's different than having to share attention and have a quieter environment. So listeners, let us know what you think. Do you think now, because of smaller family sizes, that might contribute to more introversion or more introverts? Or do you think that the number hasn't changed and it's just that there are now people who are happier now? Because that makes me laugh. Just as young Jamie is introducing Bree to Jenny, out comes everyone's favorite, Leary.
That is no one's favorite.
Uh-huh. She says, someone had said they seen Jamie riding near Baldriggan. And Leary is there with her brother, Homack. And then she sees that this person that everyone says was Jamie riding is actually a lass. And Brianna introduces herself as Jamie's daughter. Jenny asks, you're truly Jamie's lassie? Brianna answers, my mother says so. Leary is not convinced. She asks who her mother is. And Brianna answers, his wife. Who else? Brianna goes Fraser red. She thinks, oh, he would, you know, of course, Jamie would have married. You know, when my mom was gone for 20 years, it makes sense that he could have remarried. And then she wonders if her mom came through the stones and found Jamie with his new wife. And she goes to sit down and she is like, oh, she's like, oh my gosh, my poor mom. And she sees Ian. And Ian says that he's her uncle. So now we get older Ian Sr.
Well, he's the calming influence always.
Oh, always. Gracious. To be married to Jenny? Oh, my gosh. Larry thinks she's only come to see, meaning Brianna. Larry thinks Brianna's only come to see what she can get.
Well, because she only sees in others what she sees in herself.
Or what she lacks.
Yeah. She's like, no.
Or after what she's after.
Yeah. She wants it, so everyone else wants it. And they want it to take it from her.
She sees it as a threat. Yeah, her as a threat. They're arguing over the money that is owed to Leary. Leary goes wild, wild with her accusations of Bree's potential maternity. And Bree stopped arguing simply by standing. Quote, with a coolness she didn't feel, Brianna reached for her inner pocket of her coat, the secret pocket she had sewed into the seam only a week before. My mother's name is Claire, she said, and dropped the necklace on the table. Unquote. Jenny touches the pearls and greets her with, I am so very glad to see ya, niece. Leary can't take her eyes away from the pearls. Jenny says that Claire is with Jamie and that they're safe. Leary tries to claim the pearls. Like, so Jenny and Brianna are having like a little moment. And Leary's like over here. I could just imagine this tableau. I think it's going to be a very comical scene. I mean, freaky and sad, but comical. Because Jamie still owes her money. She's really like making to get these pearls. And she makes her snatch them up and Brianna grabs them.
I feel like Jenny really owed her money.
Oh, because of how she started it?
She kind of orchestrated the whole thing. I think if anybody is to blame for that farce of a marriage, it's Jenny. I think Jenny owes her the money.
I don't think Jenny has much money.
Of course she doesn't. None of them do. That's the problem.
Bree grabs the pearls before Leary can get them. And Bree gets a quick education on who she is and the history of Jamie and Leary. Leary continues with the theme of Claire as witch. Quote, she cast her spells on him from the day she came to Leah and on me. She made me invisible. From the day she came, he could not see me. Unquote. A cold shiver goes down Bree's back at this. Leary goes on about Brianna. She's a witch's child, and you know it, all of you. They should have burned her mother in Cranesmere.
Famous last words. When is someone going to punch Leary in the throat? Like, seriously, when is someone... I am so...
You're on a roll tonight. Summer was texting me earlier about being not happy with someone, and she's just like, I want to punch her in the throat. I was like, dang, Summer, settle down.
I haven't had a lot of sleep. It makes me punchy.
This is the second virtual throat punch, like, in less than an hour.
It's a little more than an hour. Just about an hour.
I'll have to check the times dip on
I'm just saying. She has a lot of gall, that Leary.
Bree is not having any of it. She slams her hand down on the table and says, hogwash. If they ought to be wary of anybody, it's you. You effing murderess. Unquote. And of course, she doesn't say effing. She says the word I would have to otherwise bleep. Coincidence that, yeah, that there you go. Thanks for the bleep, Sam.
It's convenient that Leary has never told anyone about her involvement in the Cranesmere affair. And it's also due to the fact that Claire was... Or maybe Claire just didn't have time to, or it never, I think she never anticipated Leary ever being an issue ever again. So why bring it up?
Oh, to Brianna?
Yeah. Well, not even to, no, Brianna knew. Brianna's the one who called Leary out in front of everybody. What I'm saying is to Jenny and Ian and everybody else. She never brought any, it's like the whole thing happened. They got, you know, he saved her from the witch trial or whatever. And then they're just like, we're never going to speak of this again. She's dead to us. And then it was like they never anticipated it being an issue, so they didn't bring it up. And until Leary showed back up or Claire showed back up at Lallybroch and then Leary showed back up at Lallybroch, could it have possibly come up again? And honestly, I don't know why it didn't. That would have seemed like a very good thing to have brought up when they were fighting over divorce thingies or annulments or dissolutions.
Yeah, I don't know why it didn't come up, but maybe she wanted to leave it for this scene.
Maybe. Or statute of limitations. I don't know.
If it had come up when Claire was there, it wouldn't have had the impact on everybody else, right? Because they would have heard it.
Oh, for sure. And this makes Claire the bigger person. Yeah. So
it is convenient that it's convenient for the story for Diana that Leary hadn't spilled her guts yet. But now, since she knows a thing or two, Bree speaks up. Quote, "She tried to kill my mother." Unquote. And she tells the tale of Cranesmere. She tells it all. Joe B. writes, "Her entrance to the house quickly moves from a suitable level of surprise from Jenny et al. To a grange of epic proportion. Leary has arrived to claim her pound of flesh from Jamie, ideally. But anyone will do for her as she seeks but fails to cry the poor, wronged, but virtuous woman. Leary, unsettled, plays her wild card of who she is, his wife, abandoned when the witch returned. Bree, once assured of her parents' safety and that they are together, ups the ante. No one can know how much Bree knows of her mother's story. Claire, at the time, didn't believe Leary truly knew how far the witch trial would go. Claire isn't overly vindictive, but after such trauma, not to say anything about Leary at that time, or even now, as in the book, Jamie still doesn't know of Leary's involvement, could point to Claire giving Leary the fuller part of the blame for her arrest in later years, and only when it related to Jamie. Leary never actually admits her part, but in her anger and self-righteousness, Jamie was bewitched and she was right to rid him of evil. Thus, it's perfectly fine if Jamie has a bastard child by certainly incriminates herself." Now, I have one thing about that. Doesn't Jamie know by now in DOA that she was involved? I thought he found out in book three. In the books, he didn't find out in Outlander.
Which is the only reason that he would have married her come later.
Correct.
I don't know. I don't remember.
We'll have to ask you guys.
It wouldn't have been before she came back.
I think he found out in book three. So because Claire went back in book three. So I think it was in book three because Claire wouldn't go back, go through the whole Leary thing, him being shot and all that, and then go off to America. And then suddenly we're in book four and say, oh, by the way, no, she would have said it like, because him marrying Leary, all of this crap, it was hurtful. It was shocking. It was like, of anyone to marry her, right? That's the thing. It wasn't the fact that he wanted to remarry. It wasn't the fact that she wanted him to be happy. It wasn't the fact that he found someone, not found, you know what I mean? Ended up with someone. She knew it was a possibility of her being gone. She knew that he could have gone on and maybe had more kids. He did. But she knew it was always a possibility. When she found out it was Leary, she was legit. She was more upset that he didn't tell her, obviously, but also upset that it was her of anyone. She was legit going to leave. And I think, well, okay, they did start it in the series. They did start it in the show. They showed her like getting ready to walk away, but she didn't really get very far, which whatever. It was much stronger in the books because she's like walking for like, I think a day at least. And young Ian goes after her and says that Jamie's been shot. So when she, I think in their chatting, right? I think in Voyager, she says to him, basically, it makes me so upset or I'm so hurt because you lied and because it was her. She tried to get me killed. I believe it was during that time. It could have been after he was shot, but I think it was before. I believe it was in Voyager. Anyway. Joe B. continues, "I'm loath to defend Leary, and in many things I won't, but she did have strong and long-lasting feelings for Jamie, dysfunctional and destructive though they were. After two abusive marriages, to marry Jamie and know that he doesn't or can't love her, and he never could, given the expectations she has for him, let alone the guilt she carries that must form part of the shade of Claire between them, is tragic. She is a wronged woman. I wouldn't be keen to live with a man who fantasizes about another woman when sharing my bed. But in the end, she is hoisted by her own petard and her parting shots at both Bree and Jamie show her as the angry, bitter, and jealous woman she has become. Megan P. writes, ugh, leery. No, sorry, she wrote leg hair. She ruins basically every scene in which she's present, and now poor Bree is imagining the worst. Thank goodness for Ian in this moment. He is such a calming force, which God knows the Fraser McKenzie family needs on the daily. Whoa, go Brianna. I had to wait 4 books, but I feel like someone finally managed to deliver her comeuppance. How appropriate that it was given to her by the very person that represents Jamie and Claire's love. Oh, that's a slap in the face. I never thought about it that way, Megan. Whew, that's deep. Eric B. writes, why does leg hair always have to ruin things? She is the reason why the Frasers can't have nice things. It's like she has some sort of spidey sense about when she shouldn't be there. And poor Bree having to deal with that level of crazy right off the bat. Not the easiest way to have to learn about some things, but Bree certainly schooled them too with what happened to in Cranesmere. Cindy R. writes, how totally in character for Leary to feel Claire bewitched Jamie as an explanation of him leaving her. I simply think Jamie's longing for Claire must have been palpable, but Leary prefers to think that Claire has put a spell on him. You can almost see her sizzle when she says, you can't kill a witch with steel, you must burn them. Love, love, love Brianna, putting her in her place by telling the family the long-hidden secret of Leary trying to orchestrate Claire being tried as a witch as well. Then, the description of Leary's, quote, eyes blank and dull as marbles, unquote, makes me think of zombies. Quite fitting, in my opinion. She'd take a munch out of Claire's hide if she could. I just like to pop her in the nose. Or, as Summer said, punch her in the throat.
I think the scene would have been more powerful if they'd punctuated it with a punch to the throat.
I don't know that they did throw punches back then, but I think Bree did. I must have misremembered. I thought Bree slapped her.
All I know is that Bree's in trousers. She's all prepared to punch.
Well, and she's also like 3 feet taller than her. Come on.
Now I'm envisioning the scene in The Princess Bride when Fessick, the giant, just like dunk, like hits the dude on the head and like dunk
and just falls down. Uh-huh. Hobart, thankfully, takes, oh, sorry, Homark. No, I'm not, oh my gosh, I'm making it up. Homak takes Leary away.
I love their holiday movies.
I know. Yes, you do.
They're sexy, sexy Santa movies, Homark.
Bree says, quote, he went on loving her. Like to herself, she's saying this and she's realized everything that just came out. He went on loving her. He didn't forget her. And Jenny says, oh, man, see, this is a tear break. Whew. Of course he didn't forget her. Neither did we. Megan P. writes, I love it when Jenny's tender heart shines through her no-nonsense exterior. Where family is concerned, that woman is fierce, but her love knows no bounds. Bree is experiencing an extended family for the first time ever. It's a thrill. Everyone was happy to see her for his sake, for her father's sake. No, she hadn't written Jamie to say she was coming. It's a little bit hard to do where she's coming from.
I mean, she was time traveling, but she couldn't do that kind of time traveling.
Yeah, exactly. No, she hadn't written Jamie to say she was coming, but she doesn't know where he is. She sees a portrait of her dad as a child and looks at it. The second portrait was Ellen. And of course, I immediately thought of, and Ellen too.
Yeah. Didn't we just do this last week? Didn't you just do that? I feel like you just did.
I did, but
can we not do that anymore? Like the same thing 2 weeks in a row.
Look, if Ellen is mentioned and I think about it, it comes out. Cindy R. writes, the family being delighted with her simply for Jamie's sake. This just makes my heart melt. Can you even imagine Jenny's delight? Bree is imagining. She's like, look, 200 years in the future, I will be standing in front of this portrait at the National Portrait Gallery. I mean, she's already seen it. Can you imagine how like double take, triple take, like almost out of body, weird experience she must be feeling? And she finds out from Jenny that Ellen had painted it herself. And Bree much more, or not only has a homecoming feeling for finding Lallybroch, for finding family, extended family, and finding out about her parents that they're safe. She finally gets to place a piece of herself. A piece of herself falls into place. And that is, she learns where her gift for drawing and painting came from. It came from Ellen.
I love the way that she said it, though. Frank couldn't draw a straight line. All Claire could draw was straight lines. And then, but she had the artistic flair, which I thought was cute.
Yeah, that was good. She had the gift for line and curve and shadow and light, something like that. Yeah. Megan P. writes, I love that Brianna looks like Ellen McKenzie. It just seems so right somehow with her also being in possession of the pearls. Brianna looking at the portrait and remembering the time and place the first time she saw it and realizing where she must have gotten her artistic talents was truly a special moment. Erica B. writes, I can't imagine the deja vu feeling Brie encountered with the Ellen painting. Totally creepy, in my opinion, to know that the anonymous painting you spotted 200 years in the future was, in fact, your grandmother. Cindy R. writes, when Brianna sees Ellen's portrait, the click of recognition that her talent comes from her grandmother, finding pieces of her ancestry and how they shaped her without her having an awareness of it must be exciting. The fact that she sees this exact portrait in a museum 200 years in the future is one of those aha moments that Diana loves to give us.
Grange.
Speaking of which, sidebar, if you're not a member of our exclusive Facebook community, we invite you to become a member. Summer, how do they find that?
Outlanderpod.com/group.
Yes. So you can join by going to that link. We had a poll recently. We have a poll, which I probably need to make it a pinned, like a secondary pin post so it sticks at the top. We are getting some merchandise made for us and others to purchase. And, we're asking for suggestions and people to vote in a poll about what kind of things they would like. And I think the number one out of all the things we have right now is Grange by like a margin of 2 or 3 to the next competitor. So it's crazy. It makes me laugh. I think it's awesome. Jenny gives Brie a letter. Technically, it's from her family, from her parents, but it's her dad. It's her dad. Her dad wrote it. She finds out that they're in the colony of North Carolina, and she recognizes the handwriting from what she'd read 200 years in the future. It's a letter from Fraser's Ridge, starting, because it's actually between September 19th and October 20th, I believe. So it's about a month long, on and off, of some different entries. But it starts on September 19th. The letter basically tells about the time just running up to the friend of the Tuscarora, who the Native American friend, who was ill and placed in the corn crib. And Brianna tells Jenny that she'll stay for a few days. And I always think it's funny that, not that she wants, you know, an extra 50 mouths to feed, no. But didn't it seem weird to you that, as Diana was writing, that when she's asking and checking on her, like, oh, well, you know, Brianna gets the sense that Jenny does not want her to stick around. Come stay for a little bit, yes, but not stay.
No, I think that the reason she's that way in this scene is answered by the next scene when he's like, we got to talk about what we're doing here. And you need to talk to your dad because her entire life could be uprooted by her appearance. So while she's super excited to meet her niece and finally have one, right? At the same time, it's like, what does her appearance mean? What does it mean to her whole family that has had a specific trajectory, you know, from ever since Culloden? What does it mean for them now? Will it change anything?
So she finishes the letter and it tells of two more guests, one Lord John and his son. And it discusses the loss of John's wife, etc., and the death of the guest in the corn crib. And then Jamie closes the letter. In the postscript, he says all are safe, but they find out that young Ian and Lord John were sick. And then there's a letter, page 2, that Ian had written to his mom. Erica B. writes, I love the use of Jamie's letter to describe to us how and what they are doing in North Carolina. I love this line that he writes, quote, in consequence, her fingers are purple at present, which I find most decorative, unquote. That's like, that's pure DG. I love it. As it shows his sense of humor, and it made me laugh. The letter is a great tool to give us Jamie's perspective on life and also allows us to experience the letter as if we were Bree. One thing I find interesting is the odd word capitalizations throughout the letter. Do you know why this is? Yes. There may be more technical, I don't want to say a technical reason. Basically, until the 19th century, I believe, there was,
haven't you ever read the Da Vinci Code? I'm sure it means something bigger than that.
You're hysterical.
It's a secret code.
Oh my goodness.
Go get all the capital letters and write them all next to each other. And I bet there's a secret message that says, the measles done took my manhood, mom. I don't know. There's some secret message in there.
Up until, I believe, the 19th century. Could have been early 20th, but I think that's a little bit late. And if there are any paleographers who know this, please write in, let us know. At least in English. I can't speak for German, but my guess is it's similar among different languages. That until pretty recently, there was no standard for spelling or capitalization. I believe they would, or even punctuation. So you'd have a really long, if you actually saw the handwritten part, you'd have a really long, could have really long sentences without, you know, with the final stop, but nothing else. And typically the first letter of the first word, I believe, was capitalized. But as far as those rando capitalizations, yeah, no, that's very typical of 18th century, you know, and earlier, but very typical of 18th century documents. Erica B. continues. Ian's letter I find adorable in the way a child writes to their mother, in the way I would write to my own, jokes and all. He must be okay, after all, because he could get himself to the privy. No worries, ma'am. And Cindy R. writes, hearing this recounting of events from the previous chapters is delightful. Brianna recognizing his handwriting, that seriously gives me shivers. Oh, she's so close. He actually touched the paper she's holding. His humor just shines through. Claire's decorative colored purple fingers from working with plants, tomatoes not being poison, neither Claire nor the sow being happy to have been moved into the pantry. Jamie describing Willie to Jenny seems nonchalant, but one can feel the sense of pride underneath, at least those of us in the know, as to Willie's true parenthood. She gets a little tour of Lallybroch, Brianna does, from Ian. Ian was wearing a kilt, and she could tell it wasn't something he normally did, given Jenny's reaction to him coming downstairs in it that morning. The plan is that she would be taken to Inverness to board a ship for the colonies by young Jamie. Until then, she would make the most of her time at Lallybroch, seeing as much as she could, spending as much time as she could with her family. Ian takes her all over the place, including to the tatty field. The potatoes her mother had bade them plant. She tells him that she doesn't know if Jamie knows about her or not, that she's alive, that she exists. Ian tells her that it was Jenny that suggested Jamie marry Larry. Brianna very intelligently says nothing. He tells her of the time after Culloden when Jamie was mourning the loss of her mother and that he hid after Culloden. And they're walking or hiking this entire time. And just as they finish, they get to this part of the conversation, they're at the Dunbonnet's cave.
See, now I happen to feel that her seeing that cave would have been way more of a deja vu moment than seeing the portrait. While she's never seen the cave before because she knew about the cave, she'd read about the story. So I think seeing it and having that be real also makes her dad more real. And I mean, I know she's meeting all the family and seeing all the things, and these are all the things that he lived here, he grew up here. But I mean, this was something tangible that he suffered through. So I mean, it's like, I don't know. I feel like this would be the hardest thing she's had to do so far.
Well, definitely was the hardest to squeeze herself in there.
Well, or not punching Leary in the throat might have been the actual hardest, but this would be the second hardest.
So Ian has brought her to the spot. She is at the Dunbonnet's cave. She enters it, the cave where her father had lived. And she says, she thinks to herself, I couldn't have lasted 7 days. How in the heck could he have lasted 7 years? Erica B. writes, the cave sounds miserable. I don't recall how herself described it in Voyager, but I'm sure it was just as miserable sounding. This is just a reminder of how hard it was for him. He says, once she sees Jamie, to ask him what they'd have her do with Lallybroch. Brianna assures Ian that she didn't come for that. She asks about what Leary had said. She asks about what's a fetch. Ian replies, quote, a fetch is a sight of a person when the person himself is far away. Sometimes it will be a person that's died far from home. It's ill luck to see one, but worse luck to meet your own. For if you do, you die. Unquote. They're drinking from a burn, or they take a drink from a burn. And he says that Jamie married Leary out of pity, he thinks. He reminds her that he'd left Leary's house some time before Claire returned. And when she came back, quote, he was very glad to see her, Ian said simply. This time, the smile lighted his whole face like sunshine. And so was I, unquote. Joe B. writes, seeing Jenny and Ian as aunt and uncle is contrasting. Ian is very much who he always is, but Jenny has a chance to show her softer side. As she shows Bree the house and its portraits, Jenny can have more care and less responsibility. Not her child, her brother or sister-in-law. The difference is, in pleasure of seeing Jamie's child, one she has longed to see as well. She shares the precious letters from Jamie and asks Bree to stay a little longer for her own, Jenny's, pleasures. As Jenny has shared the house with Bree, Ian shares the fields, the Dunbonnet's cave, and the Jamie he knows. Wearing the kilt is a risk, but one he deems worth taking to show Bree what Lallybroch was and what at heart it still is. Ian is the one that shares Jamie's emotional state pre-Ardsmuir and post-Hellwater, describing the lack of purpose and multiple losses, in part as explanation of why Jamie married Leary. There are references to ghosts and of Jamie's true self being somewhere else, Ian knows, as we do it's with Claire. Ian, in his unassuming way, reassures Bree of Claire's welcome in the past, not only from Jamie, but from him, too. Megan P. writes, this chapter is so good. I have felt every feeling possible to feel while reading a book. I imagine Brianna felt every feeling a human is capable of on her journey and while at Lallybroch. Her interactions with each family member are so true to everyone's character in past books. I remember starting this chapter expecting to enjoy Jenny and Brianna's interaction the most. Now having read it, I adore Ian and Brianna together. They have some really nice moments together in this chapter. Brianna is so in tune with who her father is, and she hasn't even met him yet. I enjoyed her reaction to the cave and the genuine feelings and thoughts she had while there. There was a hint of clairvoyance in her imaginings, but that doesn't surprise me considering Brianna has a bit of the second sight, so we read. I'm so glad that Ian was able to offer Brianna comfort and insight during her stay at Lallybroch. I feel like she really needed that in order to face what lies ahead for her. What an eventful chapter. I can't wait for what's next. Erica B. writes, I'm glad Ian took Bree on the walk to discuss things and the situation with Leary, helping to set Bree's mind at ease. She had to have been terribly confused with all the chaos, not knowing all the details, and Ian has always been the rational, calm one in the house. And finally, Cindy R. writes, as she tours Lallybroch with Ian, Claire's influence is near at hand. The potato fields that she suggested they plant. Ian discussing his strong teeth thanks to the greens Claire suggested they all eat. I imagine Brianna is probably feeling quite proud of her mama's influence. This chapter is one of my absolute favorites within Drums. All the feels. Meeting family, making connections between herself and the family she's never met. Putting Leary in her place. Discovery of this place her father called home. This chapter sets up the next part of Brianna's journey perfectly.
And that was chapter 34, Lallybroch. So I would say join us next time when we discuss chapter 35, but we're not going to be doing that for a little bit. And why is that, Ginger?
I don't know. You tell me, girl. I have no idea what you're talking about.
You don't get to throw that back. That's not cool.
Should we say it, or should they have to tune in next week to hear?
I mean, they can. It's all over
That's
everywhere.
That's true. It is.
It's like the whole point is I don't want you to think we're going to be moving on to the next chapter next week, because that's not the case. We're taking a brief hiatus from the read-alongs.
We're taking some time to go to a place that we all are interested in. We are going on our second official Pod Abroad, first group tour Pod Abroad.
So Pod Abroad 2018, it doesn't begin next week. It begins the week after next, but we are going to be in heavy prep.
Very heavy prep. As a matter of fact, it might even be Scottish heavy prep.
It will be. It will for sure be.
Keep an ear out. Don't worry. We're not going away. We're not doing the read-along for a smidgel of weeks, a few weeks, but there will be something to listen to. So be sure you subscribe in your favorite podcast app, and so you can hear what is in the place of the read-alongs.
Yes. And also, I would just recommend paying close attention to our other social media places, because I feel like those are going to be becoming a little more active in the coming weeks in absence of our read-along.
Coinciding with the absence of our read-along, yes, because of where we'll be and what we'll be doing, I think we'll be extra super productive, I guess you could say, or posty on our other social media places. So you can find us anywhere and everywhere that we have an account, or that you might have an account, at Outlander Pod. So as always, join us to continue the conversation in our Facebook community. Find us at outlanderpod.com/group.
And if you want to be a contributor to our Drums of Autumn read-along, there is still time and there are still chapters available. So if you go to www.outlanderpod.com/DOA, you can find out more information there.
And if you love our show and are entertained by it, please visit our Patreon page and consider supporting us. Every bit helps cover our costs, be it hosting, recording, equipment, etc. And giveaways. There are also a number of free ways to help support our show. The most important is to help spread the word. Tell your friends and family who love Outlander about our show. And thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.